Warning, this podcast details firsthand accounts of graphic crime, as well as deeply disturbing emotional profiles, and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please proceed with caution.
Well, what happened is the deaths of these victims won't be as important as it once was, you know? Won't outrage the public as their deaths once did, and eventually it will all be forgotten about and covered over by the entertainment industry just be commercial exploitation by the entertainment industry, profiteering over the deaths of these people with nothing gained or learned. In fact, more harm will be done in the long run because it might edge somebody else on.
A Molasses Manifesto production brought to you by Audio Up. You're listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. I'm your host, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley. Joining me is veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. This is Killer Tape, Season 1, David Berkowitz, a.k.a. Son of Sam.
I hope you die.
He confessed to being the 44 killer, ordered by a voice speaking through a neighbor's dog, carry out his bloody outrages against young pretty women.
I snuck up on him and shot him.
Berkowitz planned to use the revolver again and again until he felt police were getting close.
I wanted to help people. I wanted to be important to somebody, you understand?
David Berkowitz, 24 years old, found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got me.
And now the need for a story, if not for anybody else, for myself.
Police say those words ended the biggest manhunt in New York City history.
I should spend my whole life here for what I've done.
Bill and Jack in conversation. Bonus episode 1, The Son of Sam Law.
So what are we looking at here, Jack?
We're looking at the crime victim, New York State Crime Victim Compensation Board's actions regarding the so-called Son of Sam Law that was enacted to prevent mass murderers and other criminals from profiting on the proceeds of publicity relating to their crimes. And herein contained is a letter by Berkowitz who sort of took a very active role or tried to in contacting judges and lawyers and journalists, including myself, throughout the state to attempt to influence them to pass this law to deny massive profits to media organizations and others and divert instead all of the proceeds from such projects to the victims, surviving victims and families injured through the attacks by people like him.
What did you see as his motive behind that?
I think he was trying to snatch a bit of positive notoriety, positive attention from the horrible things he did, which essentially was, you know, the same thing as, like, we all know the stories of the volunteer firefighters and even paid firefighters who will start fires and then discover them and suddenly become the hero who saves people by rushing into burning buildings or reporting them.
Is that a common thing? I've never heard of that.
Really?
People starting, I've heard David talk about it in the interview, yeah. But is that a common thing of fire people?
It is. Start? It's a well-known phenomenon that they now screen applicants for. Any history of arson or any psychological issues that may, you know, or any prior fascination with fire or...
I know that David is, he seems really concerned, or Berkowitz seems really concerned about trying to kind of create a good image to counterbalance the guilt that feels the weight of doing the things that he's done. Do you see that as this as being a part of that?
Oh, yeah. The entire time that he was driving around with his guns looking for victims to murder, he had in his trunk an array of emergency equipment on several occasions, stopped and helped stranded motorists, Once he had his hand on his gun and saw what he looked like would be an ideal target, and this guy rushed up to him and said, "Oh man, we're totally stuck here." And rather than kill the guy and girl, he helped push their car out. And his big hope was that someday he would see a major building on fire or something, and he could rush in and save people. The guy needed to be known. He had a real urge for that. And the ultimate point of all these murders and maimings of innocent human beings was that he would be caught. He would be finally recognized as somebody, much like John Lennon's killer. Motivation. These guys are in search of an identity.
And an interesting thing, you're talking about him helping those people, that in a weird way, that guy saved his own life by identifying himself as a person, by speaking to Berkowitz, right? Because with one exception, I think Berkowitz, once he says, and it plays out in his crimes, that once somebody talks to him, he can't go through with it.
Right.
With one exception.
Yeah. I remember Chapman also telling me that John Lennon to me was nothing more than an album cover. You know, you have to objectify victims. And earlier that day, you might remember, John Lennon came out and was very much a human to him, signed his album, had his son with him. It was exactly the same, maybe even more so with Berkowitz, who would be leaving his job at the post office late at night or midnight, and there were women he worked with who were terrified that this Son of Sam character might be lurking and that they would be alone in their car driving home. And he walked them to their cars and reassured them. And there was another case where a woman had been walking directly at him, and he had his hand on his gun in his pocket, and she smiled and said hello, and he was frozen. So the girl who put the, you know, who knew apparently that he was a bad guy and going to shoot her, did exactly the wrong thing by holding up the book in front of her face that he shot through and killed her. I don't know, what's the advice when you encounter a bear, you know? Not to act frightened, but to try to make yourself bigger than the bear, you know, I do.
Well, because this is just for Berkowitz, too. I mean, all these guys are different, right? Like, what would work with Berkowitz right. in terms of getting you out of it would be different
right.
than what would...
No, I don't think a guy like Ed Kemper, for example, or either of the Hillside Strangler guys would have...
Wouldn't have helped.
No, they would have said, oh, yeah, come on, hop in the car. And
this good guy routine that we're discussing did not start with this, you know, his public acknowledgement of being behind this bill, or did it even start with this, the trying to help people and save people while he's out looking for people to harm, as he put it. It starts even in childhood, right?
Right. Even in childhood, he would do malicious things. And then there were a couple occasions there where he reported on the damage that was created, and oh, what a good boy you are, David, to report this. And what horrible person would have done it?
And some of it he comes by naturally, right? He's got a baby face. He's got a soft demeanor because he's not good at confronting people, right? He's not good at taking things head on, so his demeanor would sometimes be a little bit, right? And he's kind of childlike, so people don't expect him or suspect him.
Right. You know, he almost has a sort of, I don't know, pasty-faced choir boy innocent look about him, you know, and curly hair and, you know, cherubic, I guess.
That hides the soul.
That hides his soul. Yes. Very, very much so.
So this then is like the first public. So now that, I mean, he's never been a public figure in his entire life before his arrest, right? Or before, you know, the spree. So this maybe is this like his first public venture into enacting this kind of you know, good guy image out into the world in a major, wide stream way.
The Son of Sam Law?
Yeah.
Yeah, that you know, he had begun manipulating media as this, you know, so-called demonic Son of Sam, the letters he dropped and the letters he wrote to the tabloid journalist and that sort of thing. And he very quickly learned, you know, how to press those buttons. But after he was imprisoned and looking for a way, allegedly, to atone for some of the evil he had created, he seized upon this law and suddenly began viewing himself as the ultimate victim's advocate against this awful system of sensationalist media that were further going to exploit the crimes. And according to him, books and movies would only inspire more people to do what he had done, as well as denying victims any claim from the proceeds of these projects, unless they specifically were signed on.
And do you feel any conflicting feelings about him getting behind this at that time? Because it's, you know, in one way, it's a good thing that he's doing, mm-hmm. and in another way, it plays into his mm-hmm. plan.
Right. His, to what he ultimately was doing, which was working to achieve an identity and be recognized as a valid human being, I suppose, who actually contributed something and didn't just start fires and just murder people anonymously.
It almost feels like he's trying to right the scales that cannot be righted.
Right, right.
Do you want to go ahead and read us this letter?
Okay. It's addressed to Judge Venturi, State Supreme Court, January 29th, 1979, which was fairly soon after he had arrived at Attica. Did I say 1979? I just read in the Rochester, New York newspaper that a movie and book is being written about me. No doubt I'm once again the last to know because of all the crooked deals that must be worked out beforehand. I'm advising you that I am not going to cooperate in any way with the writer or movie makers in this venture. I have no interest in such nonsense, and if Hollywood wants to glorify my name and what I've done, then let them. Maybe after some disturbed person sees the movie, he too will go out and kill some people, then someone will make a movie about him, then another and another. Secondly, I want to tell you that I do not wish to receive one single penny from any profits that will be made. I want nothing except to be left alone and spend the rest of my life in prison until I die, which will be soon because I have enemies. However, I'm not the least bit concerned. Judge Ventieri, sir, I am also going to beg you that you do not let the Moskowitzes or the Violantes make all the profits from the deal. Please make sure that Joanne Lomino also gets a share of the royalties. Don't forget that she is more handicapped as a result of my actions than all the others combined. Please make sure that everything is split fairly and don't let the crooked ones like the Moskowitzes get it all. I would strongly desire that all the proceeds, if possible, go to the Victims Crime Compensation Board. One last point, please. I want you to realize that any story about me would be somewhat fictional since I made up the story about the demons. It wasn't really true. I'm the real demon. I realize this now. However, I don't suppose it matters because people want to read something absurd and Hollywood knows it would sell better. I just thought I would let you know, and I hope you will consider everything I've said. Most sincerely, David Berkowitz, 78A-1976, Box 149, Attica, New York.
Wow. What goes through your head when you read that? That's a pretty powerful letter.
It is. It's and it's articulate and, you know, well written and to the point. I think that there is a good deal of sincerity that, you know, he is, you know, but, you know, what his, this calling one of the victims' families crooked, that throws me a bit.
Why?
And I guess it's because he sees them as, you know, as somehow trying to capitalize and take this big pile of money that somebody is going to get.
Also not in a position to be calling anybody crooked. He took their daughter away from them.
Exactly.
Permanently exactly. And
yeah.
Forever.
Yeah. No, this is this entire issue is better worked out by, you know, people with ethics and morality and some legal training and, you know, maybe his...
Then convicted murderer David Berkowitz.
Right.
I also notice here that it says January 29th, 1979 on this letterhead here, which I believe is just a few months before he gets stabbed in prison.
He was stabbed, I think it was July 9th or July 10th. So, yeah, this would be about 6 months.
Of the same year, right.
Of the same year before someone, and according to the grapevine in the prison system, the person who tried to kill him had been hired to do so on contract by a mafia-linked relative of one of the victims. And I had heard, you know, I don't know for sure, but... the possibility that the people he cites in this letter would be one of the families connected to the man who was ultimately transferred to Auburn Prison, where he was killed, and reputedly that was to keep him from talking about having been hired to do the killing, which he botched.
So why do you think he makes reference here? Do you think it's because in general he knows that he's disliked within the prison, or do you think that he has some kind of specialized information like you're referring to?
I think he knew he was a target. Any famous, you know, quote, famous, infamous person who goes to prison is going to be targeted by other prisoners who are doing multiple life sentences who will never get out, like the guys who threatened John Lennon's killer, simply to be known as the guy who killed the guy who killed the great John Lennon, or who killed all of these people.
It's not hard math. Plus, right. This individual, David Berkowitz, obviously, that we're discussing, killed young women.
Right, right.
Which is also disliked within the prison system.
Yeah. There was another story after the unsuccessful slashing attempt to cut his throat and sever his jugular vein, which left him with about 60 stitches in his all around his neck. Someone contacted Stacy Moskowitz's mother, who said she would like to shake the hand of the man who had attempted to kill him, and that's understandable.
And even once again, it turns out into this strange and upsetting positive for him. I read in one of the transcripts him discussing the fact that it gave him some cred. Makes him look tough within the prison.
Oh, yeah.
That he's walking around with this sign now
on
his neck.
Yeah. And during at least one, and I think a couple of our interviews, you know, he was very proud to describe himself as probably the most famous murderer in the country now, today, except for maybe Charles Manson.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was proud to be in that company.
The interesting thing about that is that he often, you know, displays this pride that you're talking about in terms of, you know, he looks up to these other people, he watches books and movies, which is part of the reason that he's so, you know, serious about clamping this down, because he knows firsthand the effect that it had on him. But in terms of the individual crimes, the shootings, the murders, he doesn't really want to talk. He's not proud of them individually in the same way, right? Do you see that? Because he doesn't want to discuss them. Do you think that's an act? Do you think he really isn't proud of them? How do you unpack that?
I think he was in a state of near terror every time he shot somebody. I mean, I don't see him as a courageous person at all. He tried to look courageous. But he was, like a lot of these guys, a sniveling coward. And he also had, you know, his sexuality was almost non-existent. I mean, other than this Oedipal complex as a child. And he was... You know, the whole history showed him as being extremely awkward around women. The only sex that I know for sure that he ever admitted ever having was with prostitutes when he was stationed in Korea. And I think he was, this was, you know, these murders were pent-up sexual frustrations in one sense. I don't think he had orgasm when he killed people. Mm. But
which happens.
Which does happen in some cases. He never talked about that. I don't think he was, you know.
So it plays into the driver that is well documented by him in the interviews of how his bio mother plays into all of this.
Right. Right, women are on...
Which feeds back into the Oedipal that you're talking about, is that when you look at this this issue with him, sexuality, women, motherhood, childhood, it's all kind of wrapped up into this ball. It seems less separated for him than it is for most of us. Your childhood, your mother, your sexual life... You know, for a lot of people, those are very separate.
Right. Right. And his adoptive mother was a near saint. He really...
Pearl.
Yeah. Even though he did vicious things behind her back, killed her parakeet, and...
Any number of things that he discusses, yeah.
And was, you know, a bad kid by his own admission. I think he deeply loved his adoptive mother. I mean, like she was some goddess.
She kind of was. She survived cancer multiple times. Yeah. She adopted a child that needed a mother, and then she poured everything she had into this kid. And they didn't have much money, right? They didn't have much money. They didn't have much means. And when she saw that he needed something psychologically, even though it was the early 1960s and it couldn't have been that common, she supplied that for him like a good mother would. She took him, she drove him to Manhattan, which was out of their borough, and made sure he got what he needed. And I believed he saw that therapist for nearly 3 years or something in that. Mm-hmm. You know, that's no small thing financially in terms of time. And also in terms of stigma, like how that may have looked in the neighborhood, you know, in 1960, whatever, that you're taking your child to the therapist, you know, I could imagine that there would have been some snickering about that as well. So, you know, whenever I look at what she did and was documented to have done in his life, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I think she was a very good woman who wanted to have to raise him to be a responsible human that she could someday be proud of. You know, say, this is my son, never knowing what she had adopted into her life.
And she never did, though, because she died in 1967.
No, she died when he was, yep.
So what we have here in front of us in terms of this book is a book that is a compilation of letters, articles, all pertaining to the Son of Sam Law, correct?
Right.
Okay. So can you tell us how the law kind of came about and what the end result was with it? Was it passed? You know, like, where did it come from?
It came from public outrage when these deals were being, I mean, everybody wanted to know more about this
in relation to Berkowitz specifically, this law came about, which is why it's known as the Son of Sam Law.
Right. And while the murders were still taking place, Jimmy Breslin published a horrible book, but, you know, fictionalized and speculative, and I guess made a good deal of money on it. And the public was kind of waking up and becoming aware of the outrage that, I mean, Berkowitz could have written his own story, negotiated a deal with a publisher for millions of dollars, and, you know, money talks in prison is loud or louder than it does in general society. So to think of this guy who had murdered and maimed all these people enriching himself off of those crimes, there was a sense of public outrage, and, you know, groups of attorneys, among others, began drafting the so-called Son of Sam Law to prevent criminals from enriching themselves as a result of high-profile crimes.
And when it comes out publicly, Berkowitz immediately gets behind it.
Right.
Supporting it.
Right.
For some of these reasons that we discussed earlier. And in the letter, he discusses how he refuses to be involved with some of these, with these movies and books, but he makes exceptions, right? Because as I remember, he kind of delineates a difference between content that would encourage, you know, at least what he puts out there into the world, that his concern is that it's going to cause more people to murder. Because I know from the interview, from the transcript, he discusses seeing different films and saying, these films gave me permission, these films validated me, that the self-professed effect that it had on him.
Taxi driver, for example.
Yeah. Right, correct. So he's concerned about the effect that it's going to have on others. But in the case of working directly, of course, on a book with Abrahamson, the psychologist that worked with him in a couple different points in his life, and you, he made an exception, and he made that exception for specific reasons. Can you tell me about that?
Right. His justification for that was that it would promote the law that he was very proud to have called the Son of Sam Law.
No, that's his work with more, you.
Right.
Right.
Right. And I think also with Abrahamson, when he agreed to work with him on the book and allow Abrahamson to use all of the psychiatric interviews, he had to give permission for that.
I got the idea that he felt that Abrahamson was someone that could expose him to the world in terms of delivering like an accurate psychological profile of him, which again feeds into the narcissism, but also kind of gives society some actual information that we could act on in order to keep this from happening again.
Right. Yeah. He was very big on, you know, opening himself up to whatever psychiatric or journalistic probing might enable parents, teachers, therapists to identify the next Son of Sam out there, rather than a movie which would glorify and make somehow admirable this mass murderer as anti-hero.
Because the interesting thing, and something we were discussing last night, was that when you strip away this kind of the cherubic face and the nice guy facade, which he did a lot of work to build up over the course of his life, there's a pretty clear escalation pattern with him. And escalation is a very identifiable thing for most of these guys.
Yeah.
Right? Is that you really, there often is a recognizable escalation pattern.
Right. Many of them torture pets, small animals, you know.
Arson, big one.
Right. Set small fires, destroy their parents or other adults, personal things behind their back. You know, he would squeeze out his mother's lipstick tubes and a lot of just small malicious acts that were in one way calculated to get attention and in some cases designed to try to get himself punished for real or imagined offenses against God.
Right. Right, but then in a weird way, not to make it easy, right? He's still doing everything he can to get away with it. It's interesting because I almost feel like, you know, he feels rejected by society from an early age. And so some of these childlike things that we're talking about, antisocial behavior, mechanisms that he can use or that he uses in order to feel like he's not just powerless, that he's not just being rejected, that he's doing something back to society and has some kind of power.
Right.
One of the really interesting ones I read about from him was the joy that really stood out to me was the joy that he had in describing specifically taking $1 bills out of his mother's purse. And he really, I mean, you could tell he has a lot of joy reliving the experience in the interview. And he's describing a situation in which he would look and survey, you know, with almost like a photographic kind of intensity of looking at where all the items were in the purse and making sure that it was just a precision extraction of this $1. So that it's like that he wants to get caught, he feels guilty, he hates himself, but he doesn't want to make it too easy, right? He's like, he wants to do everything so that when he gets caught, it's the ultimate punishment. Because if he just goes in there and he just kind of ransacks the purse, he gets the punishment, right? But it's not, he just kind of threw it away. I don't know. It's very mm-hmm. strange. Mm-hmm. So returning to the Son of Sam law, what happens? It gets passed. What happens? Is it here today? Walk us through that.
Yeah, it has been the subject of several court challenges by media, and it has been weakened, but it is still essentially effect to prevent. You know, to prevent people from being encouraged to go out and commit massive crimes mm-hmm. for the purpose of enriching themselves or their family. You know, let's say I'm going to go kill 1,000 people. Somebody's going to write a book about me, and I will die. But you know, my family is going to get a lot of money from this. You know?
Yeah, because that's occurred several times.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these guys do have families, not, of course, in the case of David Berkowitz, but many of them do, and many of them see this as an opportunity to take care of their families after they're gone.
Right.
And even you and I, when we made our movie last year on the assassination of John Lennon, interacted with this law in a way because no money went to Mark.
Right.
Okay, so you want to keep flipping through and...
One of the points I wanted to make here or somewhere else was that the ultimate purpose of the murders and the other, many of his other acts of malice were to be caught and to get the attention. I think particularly in the case of the murders toward the end, where he was parking by fire hydrants and you know.
That's a really odd one.
Yeah.
Seeing the cops writing the ticket, knowing that he has the ticket, I believe it was 45 minutes before the next murder, and mm-hmm. also being someone, again, very common with these guys, someone who is a sort of a quasi-student of the law or law mm-hmm. enforcement. These guys are often, I don't know if I want to say the word often, but it's been well documented. It seems to be a pattern of these guys being security guards previously or watching material on how police, reading material on how police do investigations and, you know, kind of fanboys of this stuff in some way. They've done their research, a lot of them, and they know. He knew. And he went forward with the shooting anyway.
Right. Getting caught and being punished is very often the chief objective. He was a nobody after, you know, particularly after his military service, and he's dumped back on the streets in New York, like a lot of the Vietnam vets I knew, like the antagonist in Taxi Driver, and like Chapman, you know, who talks very eloquently about this horrible feeling of being a nobody. And once he was caught, I mean, the arresting officers and everybody who dealt with him were astonished at how tractable, you know, he was, and mm-hmm. you know, a nice guy and affable, I mean, smiling, because he was getting recognition. And I think one of the most difficult things we as humans have is, I mean, it's like negative attention is better than no attention whatsoever.
For these guys. Right.
I mean, we all want to be recognized for doing something worthwhile in life, you know. Earning money.
And most of us would be abhorred at the idea of being recognized for something far below murder. I mean, anything just even embarrassing or inappropriate.
Yeah.
Socially.
Yeah.
But it's different here.
Yeah. And a lot of these guys have studied Adolf Hitler and, you know, some famous horrible people. And it's like, well, at least, you know, the world knows who Hitler was, you know. Mm-hmm. At least the world knows, you know, a lot of us know who David Berkowitz is and a number of these other mass murderers, because they did something so horrible that it shocked us all into paying attention to them. You know, negative attention, but it's still attention. And then in the case of Berkowitz and Chapman and others, you know, they try to turn it around. They're more than happy to be interviewed by forensic psychiatrists and people who might tell their story and contribute to the Secret Service files on how to identify a potential next shooter of a famous or, you know, political figure.
To stop or ideally prevent.
Yeah.
You know, early on, there was some way of creating a profile that, you know, it's such a double-edged sword, though, because you want to be able to look at society and help people that need help. But on the other hand, you know, there may be people that are exhibiting these traits that aren't on that track.
Right.
It's a very complicated scenario, mm-hmm. but I do think that there's a benefit from looking and examining the life of someone like David Berkowitz and being smarter as a society to say, you know what, we might have a problem here.
Yeah.
With a young guy or a girl, you know.
No, and my personal feeling is, even though I'm liberal, I'm against capital punishment. I think that a guy like Berkowitz, Chapman, where there's absolutely no doubt that they did these crimes, should be psychologically analyzed, you know, 24 hours a day beyond the point of exhaustion, if that would yield some usable information, including, I mean, you know, opening up their skulls and looking at the part of the brain that might be involved in this stuff.
To save one life.
To save one innocent life.
Including theirs.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you could save their life, because these people throw their lives away. In a way, you know. Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, Berkowitz is, he's a big man on campus in prison.
Right. And happy in prison, too.
Mm-hmm. No, I remember asking him if you were somehow released on a technicality, do you think you would kill again? He just said, oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he nodded. He was very affirmative about that.
Terrifying.
Yeah.
So should we flip through and see if we find some more items of interest here?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in here. The Committee on Professional Ethics, the issue of psychiatrists and that sort of, and those people, you know, actually writing profiting on the legal work that they do with these guys.
You mentioned before that the Son of Sam Law had been weakened. What were you referring to?
I think that as it was initially proposed, it would have prevented the writing of even books like the one that Dr. Abrahamson wrote, that are, you know,
non-salacious, earnest examination,
an effort to be scientific and do something preventative, that, you know, by way of the general public, you know, parents, teachers, whomever might be dealing with problem children, truant, you know, officers. Do truant officers still exist? I don't know. People who deal with, like, these, you know, juvenile delinquents, what we used to call.
So what was the purpose of this book that you have in your hands here?
This was put together as evidence for why New York State needed a stronger and more comprehensive law to compensate victims of the kind of horrors that not just serial killers and mass murderers inflict. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, people who are assaulted and crippled and blinded or whatever, and the course of robbery, you know, it was to...
So this was a document that was put together for the express purpose of aiding in the passing of the law.
Right. Because of all the publicity surrounding the Son of Sam case. And Berkowitz had a lot to do with this. He was the one who labeled himself Son of Sam, and it's, you know, this tricky little appellation that everybody
glommed onto,
so it became a law. It became, you know, synonymous with serial killing.
Because you hit upon a thing here, because one of the really unfortunate aspects of all of this is the naming of the killer, right? We see that time and time again.
Right.
You see, they always have a name or two that come out that don't stick and all the papers often are trying to be the one that comes up with this name, and they often don't get famous or grab the public imagination unless they hit on this name.
And this was probably the most the most chilling and sort of easily, you know, trippingly easily understood description of a serial killer since Jack the Ripper.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is 1979, this document?
This is 1979.
Okay, and this is around the time that you met Berkowitz.
Right, right. And, you know, after I received a letter from him I also received letters from a woman who had sought him out in prison, who had apparently, one of these women who go after famous criminals, particularly murderers, and strike up correspondence. I mean, there's a whole subgroup of people who are want to be pen pals with bad guys.
Okay. All right. Let's thank you for examining that. That's really interesting. And even though, correct me if you think I'm wrong here, but even though this does kind of play into his ploy to improve his public image, the law is a good thing.
The law is a good thing. It's unfortunate, maybe, that it's known as the Son of Sam law from the standpoint that it
plays even further.
Aggrandizes his notoriety. But the law that would prevent guys from making a lot of money if we're doing horrible things is, I think a good thing.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. Killer Tape is written and produced by me, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley, as well as veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional writing and producing by Allison Baker. Executive producers include Jared Gutstadt, Jimmy Jelinek, and Phil Alberstadt. Research assistance by Olivia Pepper. Transcription services provided by Laura Klein Shaw. Editing and sound design by Molasses Manifesto Productions. Original score by Ben Von Wildenhaus. Artwork by Mike Gabriel. Killer Tape is based on 19 hours of audio recorded with David Berkowitz inside Attica Prison in March of 1980 by veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional resources for the series include Confessions of Son of Sam by David Abrahamson, M.D., and Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner. Special thanks to Christian Bernhardt, Shelby Shankman at UTA. Stay safe out there.